Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for August 2016. We'll feature accelerometers in diagnosis and treatment of late-life depression. Two articles represent new research on pharmacotherapy. One's a population-based study of concomitant use of SSRIs and statins. The other one's a clinical trial that treated cognitive impairment in schizophrenia with an alpha-7 nicotinic receptor agonist. We'll also look at substance use. Two articles examine adolescent marijuana use in relation to subclinical psychotic symptoms and in relation to mortality at age 60. Nicotine exposure was the subject of a birth cohort study from Finland, which examined the relation of cotinine levels in pregnant women to the development of schizophrenia in their offspring. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the August highlights with our treatment in psychiatry feature on accelerometers in late-life depression. Depressive symptoms in late life can be challenging to diagnose because clinical presentations are varied. Also, patients may have comorbid cognitive impairment, and clinical information may be unreliable or biased. Ipsit Vahia and Daniel Sewell describe how accelerometer-based technology can provide diagnostic information and contribute to treatment. Currently available devices can provide quantified information on physical activity and sleep. Major depressive disorder in late life is associated with impaired sleep architecture, less time in slow-wave sleep, and more time in REM sleep compared with non-depressed individuals. Wrist-worn actigraphy may not be as accurate as polysomnography, but several studies have used it as the primary objective measure of sleep. Actigraphy has been recommended to identify patients who may be at risk for poor depression outcomes because of poor sleep. Also, depression in older adults, especially those with cognitive impairment, can present primarily as amotivation and neurovegetative symptoms. Psychomotor retardation has been reported as more common among older adults. Objective measurement of motion can improve the ability to establish psychomotor retardation. It may also help identify subsyndromal depression, which may be up to 3 times as common as major depression in older adults. Sensor technology is now widespread in smartphones, and it can have a role in monitoring mental health status. In one study, motion-related data collected by cell phone sensors correlated with changes in depression symptoms. Exercise has a molecular effect on the brain, especially the hippocampus and frontal cortex. It can affect both cognition and depression. Exercise has a modest advantage over placebo in reducing depressive symptoms and has the potential to improve cognition. It can also be efficacious in managing subsyndromal symptoms. When exercise is used in treatment, wearable motion monitoring devices may give clinicians a way to monitor adherence and efficacy. They also provide positive reinforcement to patients. Now we'll turn to our research on substance use. Adolescents who use marijuana regularly may be at a higher risk of developing subclinical and clinical psychotic symptoms. However, the association could be explained by reverse causation or other factors. To address these questions, Jordan Bechtold and colleagues examined whether adolescents who engage in regular marijuana use have a subsequent increase in subclinical psychotic symptoms. They also looked at whether the symptoms persisted during long periods of abstinence. The participants were 1,000 boys who were randomly selected from public schools in either the first or seventh grade. They were examined every year from age 13 to 18 to determine self-reported frequency of marijuana use and the presence of subclinical psychotic symptoms. For each year that the teens engaged in weekly marijuana use, their level of subsequent subclinical psychotic symptoms rose by 21%. The increase was greatest for paranoia, but hallucinations also rose substantially. The effect of prior regular marijuana use on subsequent subclinical psychotic symptoms persisted even if the teen stopped using marijuana for a year. One possible explanation for the relationship between marijuana use and subclinical psychotic symptoms is that the boys used marijuana as self-medication for the symptoms. However, this wasn't supported by the temporal relationships in the data. The teens were not more likely to engage in regular marijuana use after an increase in their psychotic symptoms. Our other study on marijuana use examined long-term mortality. Cannabis smoke has many elements in common with tobacco smoke, and some of the same long-term health effects have been documented. In addition, cannabis use is related to non-affective psychosis, which has an elevated mortality rate. So Edison Manrique Garcia and colleagues looked at mortality rates at age 60 in Swedish men who had reported on cannabis use when they'd entered the military at age 18 or 19. The study cohort comprised nearly all the men conscripted into the military in 1969 and 1970. At that time, they filled out questionnaires on drug use, including the number of times they'd used cannabis. This was categorized as never, moderate use, and heavy use. Heavy use was defined as more than 50 instances of cannabis use up to the time of conscription. The men were followed in a Swedish National Cause of Death Register up to around age 60. Diagnoses of psychotic disorders were identified from a national inpatient register. The subjects with a baseline history of heavy cannabis use had a 40% higher risk of death at age 60 compared to the men who had never used cannabis. The subjects with psychotic disorders also had an elevated mortality rate, but it didn't differ between men with and without a history of cannabis use. Only one cause of death was significantly related to cannabis use. Compared to subjects with no cannabis history at the time of conscription, those with a baseline history of moderate or heavy use had a higher percentage of deaths due to injuries, either accidental or intentional. The number of persons was small, but it's possible that cannabis use might trigger impulsive acts that ultimately lead to death. Even though the subjects with an earlier history of heavy cannabis use had a significantly higher risk of death, the authors recommended that the results be interpreted with caution. In particular, the study didn't collect information on substance use for the period after conscription. Now we'll turn to the study of prenatal nicotine exposure. Cigarette smoking during pregnancy is one of the most common adverse exposures during the fetal period. Nicotine readily crosses the placenta into the fetal bloodstream. Nicotine targets fetal brain development, causing changes in cognition, neuromorphology, and neurotransmitter function. Previous findings on the link between maternal smoking and schizophrenia in offspring have been contradictory. To overcome earlier design limitations, Solya Niemela and colleagues based their research on a national registry of pregnant women with objective measurements of nicotine exposure. The study included all live births in Finland from 1983 to 1998, in which there were archived maternal prenatal serum specimens. The samples were drawn from early to mid-gestation and were used to measure levels of cotinine, the primary metabolite of nicotine. Cases of schizophrenia in the offspring of these women were identified from a national registry and were matched to control subjects. Higher prenatal maternal cotinine levels were related to greater odds of schizophrenia in the offspring. Maternal nicotine exposure was also examined as a categorical variable by dividing the levels into three exposure categories. The highest exposure category was related to a 38% increased odds of schizophrenia. The findings were not accounted for by maternal age, maternal or parental psychiatric disorders, or socioeconomic status. The offspring born to mothers with high cotinine levels were more likely to be born with low weight for gestational age. However, there was no evidence that weight mediated the relationship between maternal nicotine exposure and offspring with schizophrenia. There are several mechanisms by which nicotine could alter fetal brain development so as to increase schizophrenia risk. Prenatal nicotine given to rats reduces the number of cells in the whole brain and some subregions. Prenatal nicotine is also associated with abnormal development of cerebral inhibitory neurons. It also causes uteroplacental underperfusion and increases carboxyhemoglobin levels. Moreover, maternal cigarette smoking has been connected with epigenetic effects related to schizophrenia. It's also linked to abnormal DNA methylation patterns. Now we'll look at psychopharmacologic treatments, starting with antidepressants. Many patients have only a partial response. Numerous alternative strategies are being investigated, and one that's shown some promise is treatment with anti-inflammatory agents. Statins have direct anti-inflammatory effects that aren't mediated by their lipid-lowering activity. Ole Kohler and colleagues used national data registries in Denmark to investigate concomitant treatment with SSRI antidepressants and statins. The data covered a national cohort of more than 800,000 SSRI users. 13% of them used a statin concurrently. Compared with SSRI treatment alone, the combined use of an SSRI and a statin was related to a significantly lower risk for both psychiatric hospital contacts and psychiatric hospital contacts due to depression. The only specific SSRI-statin combination that was present in large enough numbers to examine was citalopram plus simvastatin compared with citalopram alone. This combination showed the same reductions in contacts with psychiatric hospitals, both in general and for depression specifically. A well-known adverse effect of statins is dose-dependent myopathy. In rare cases, it may progress to life-threatening rhabdomyolysis. So another outcome measure in this study was mortality rate. Compared with SSRI treatment alone, the combination of SSRIs and statins was not related to significant increases in overall mortality. An exploratory analysis did show an increased mortality rate for the combination of lovastatin with any SSRI. However, this was based on only 4 cases of death among the individuals treated with lovastatin combination. Another outcome measure was the suicide rate. It's been suggested that lowering cholesterol levels may increase the risk for suicidal ideation. However, the data did not show that the concomitant use of SSRIs and statins was related to increased suicidal behavior. If anything, the results indicated a potential protective effect of citalopram combined with simvastatin relative to citalopram alone. We'll conclude with the trial of a possible treatment for cognitive impairment in schizophrenia. Cognitive dysfunction is a core component of schizophrenia and affects multiple domains. Alpha-7 neuronal nicotinic receptors play a key role in cognitive function. And so George Haig and colleagues tested a selective agonist that's had benefits for cognitive domains that are negatively affected in schizophrenia. The agonist is called ABT-126. Two different daily dosages, 10 and 25 milligrams, were compared with placebo. The study participants had a diagnosis of schizophrenia and had remained clinically stable for several months while being treated with atypical antipsychotics. About 200 patients were randomly assigned to the three treatments. The trial lasted 12 weeks. Overall, ABT-126 showed a dose-dependent improvement in cognition, but the difference wasn't statistically significant. However, the results differed between smokers and non-smokers. The investigational treatment had no effect in the subjects who were smokers, but there was a large effect in non-smokers. Non-smoking subjects treated with ABT-126 had a significant monotonic dose-related response on the composite score for the Matrix Consensus Cognitive Battery. Changes for both dosage groups were numerically larger than those for the placebo group in every cognitive domain. Statistically significant differences were observed in the domains of verbal learning, working memory, and attention. The rate of adverse events was similar to that for placebo. ABT-126 did not appear to be linked to gastrointestinal effects, which are common for nicotine or other non-selective nicotinic agonists. The rate of treatment discontinuation was higher in the group receiving 25 milligrams of ABT-126 than in the 10 milligrams and the placebo groups. However, the rates of discontinuation specifically due to adverse events were similar across all treatment groups. There were no notable differences in suicidality or in laboratory, EKG, or physical exam results. This concludes our audio highlights of the August issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include trichotillomania, adding antidepressants to antipsychotics, outcomes of citalopram dose reduction in veterans, heritable and non-heritable pathways to early callous unemotional behaviors, and how marriage affects the risk for onset of alcohol use disorder. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.